Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
When I wake up in the afternoon, which pleases me to do, don't nobody bring me no bad news.
If you're a fan of the printed newspaper, here's some good news. A tech entrepreneur is investing in newspapers starting in our region.
When I looked at that newspaper, there was just a lot of pictures, a lot of stories about things going on in the community, and I just thought it was a lot of content in the paper, and I was really impressed with that.
Plus,
the stories are a gift with reason and purpose.
Her Ojibwe roots go back millennia, from the East Coast to Madeline Island and the Point of Rocks in Duluth. Linda Lagarde Grover shares her latest memoir. All that and the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
When I wake up in the afternoon, which pleases me to do.
If you're a fan of the printed newspaper, here's some good news. A tech entrepreneur is investing in newspapers starting in our region.
When I looked at that newspaper, there was just a lot of pictures, a lot of stories about things going on in the community, and I just thought it was a lot of content in the paper, and I was really impressed with that.
Plus,
the stories are a gift with reason and purpose.
Her Ojibwe roots go back millennia, from the East Coast to Madeline Island and the Point of Rocks in Duluth. Linda Lagarde Grover shares her latest memoir. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Every day, it seems, you hear about how newspapers, printed on newsprint and delivered to your door, are a dying form of media, and our area is no exception. We've seen some cut from daily print editions to a couple of times per week, and others closed entirely. But the 128-year-old Weekly in Grand Marais, Minnesota, part of our listening area across the lake from Wisconsin's northern border, has been given a new life. Early this year, it was bought by Jeremy Gaubin, a tech entrepreneur from New Jersey, who found himself intrigued, if not bitten, by the newspaper bug, as well as the natural beauty of the region. That purchase was followed by that of more newspapers around the country, including 20 sold to him by Gannett, the country's largest newspaper publisher. He also restarted a daily newspaper in International Falls. Now, Cherry Road Media, an offshoot of Gulbin's Cherry Road Technologies, publishes 27 newspapers, and he joins me from New Jersey. Welcome to Simply Superior, Jeremy Gaubin.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
So when did you first hear of Grand Marais, Minnesota, and when did you first visit?
Okay, great question. So last year, I was struck with the idea that it might be interesting and a good use of our technology skills and tools to get into the local community newspaper business. And I went out to a website that lists businesses for sale around the country. And there were several papers available for sale at the time, one of which was the Cook County News Herald. And I clicked on the link and it linked to a local business broker, Steve Bragg. And I gave Steve a call and started talking to him about it. And he was going on and on about the area and how beautiful it was up there. And so I became intrigued by it and, you know, continued the conversations and wound up taking a trip out to Grand Marais for the first time, September of last year, met with the owners of the paper and worked out a deal to purchase it. And then went back in November, you know, right when the state was shutting down for COVID for the winter again. And that's when we actually, announced to the staff about the purchase. So I've stayed in Duluth for the night, woke up having breakfast and read about the shutdown and got in the car and drove up the shore and met for 40 minutes with everybody, said hello, and then went back to Duluth and went home for the winter. So it was kind of an interesting timing there.
Well, part of that timing, I hear you say your first visit was in September. So it's the trick that we do up here is we tell you, yes, you definitely come on by June, July, August, maybe September is great too. We don't, you know, necessarily have that same sales pitch in January.
Oh, I'm sure. Yes. Even November was quite a bit different than September. But I did go out by you all about, I think three times this summer. So that was definitely experienced the weather there. And I tell everybody I talk to around the country, there's no better weather in the United States in the summer than on the North Shore.
Absolutely. And South Shore.
Yes, South Shore as well. Yes.
Right. And in truth, actually, yes, it does get 20 below, but we do love the winter here too. But you have not been in the newspaper business or had not been. Did you have the newspaper at all growing up? Maybe make your own paper for your family or something like that?
No, I mean, I used to read the newspaper growing up and, you know, just a lot of online news I would always follow. And, you know, I've been thinking it through as going through this adventure here that I probably always had a passion for the news business, newspapers, and just never realized it until, you know, until I turned 45. I think I've always kind of had this bug all along and just didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm. And you had a different bug. Your career has been in the tech business. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So my career has been up first half of my career, I guess you could say, was in the technology business and working for my family's company that, you know, my dad started in 1983. And we do a lot of different technology services today. But traditionally, what we've done is we've implemented complex systems for larger organizations. So finance, payroll, you know, systems such as that. And now we've gotten into the internet service business. And we also have a whole cloud hosting infrastructure where we host websites and other applications.
And I want to say hosting websites, were any of those newspapers or any kind of news outlet?
I don't think so, but that's certainly, you know, part of our vision going forward is how can we leverage that technology for our own newspapers, as well as other businesses in the community, as well as other newspapers out there that we can be of assistance to.
Mm-hmm. So we successfully grilled you that, no, you did not have any other newspaper experience at all. The mere fact you said that you read the newspaper, that's a lot more than a lot of people today. So
we're working on changing that. But yes, that's unfortunately the case today.
Right. So why are you optimistic about newspapers? And what are you going to do differently to ensure their survival? And more than survival, thriving, I assume, right?
Well, I think that's the case. And I'll tell you that earlier this week, I was in Colorado for a meeting of mostly non-publicly held newspapers, but some of the larger family-owned chains that are multi-generation owners of newspapers. And there's a whole new generation of leaders that are stepping in and really looking to change things, bring new ideas and energy to the business. And I really came away really excited about the future. Now, we still got some headwinds here in the short term. As everyone knows, you know, the big tech, Google, Facebooks of the world have really cannibalized newspapers' viewership and advertising revenue. And so, you know, we need some help in the short term. And Minnesota Senator Klobuchar has been a real ally to the industry on this and pushing for a law to allow newspapers to negotiate collectively with the big tech companies, which we're hopeful will pass here in the near future, as well as the there's also a provision in the Build Back Better bill that's going through Congress that would provide some tax incentives for newspapers to retain and hire journalists, you know, which is the key to the newspaper business, right? The people who are out there producing the content that the readers like to read. So we're really optimistic about those two solutions to help us in the short term while we get through the storm and then get through a bigger, better future, which I just really am excited about after meeting with all these folks in the industry this week.
Mm-hmm. And again, and not to harp on the negative, right next door, the Lake County News Chronicle was very similar to the Cook County News Herald. I know this because I used to be the editor and the publisher.
Interesting. Okay.
I found a date book where I stopped by the Cook County News Herald and had dinner with, I'm trying to figure out whether it was the editor or the publisher. I said publisher in my date book, but I remember that dinner. It was wonderful. It may have been, is it Brian Larson?
So Brian Larson's the editor up there. Right. And then Hal and Deidre Kudinen were the former owners of the paper that we purchased it from.
And I've got Ken Kudinen in my date book, and that's the father.
Oh, that's
gone
Hal's
on.
Father. Yes.
Right. Well, anyway, okay. I'll call Brian. We weren't competing. Each county had its own paper. They really were licenses to print money because at that time you had county legal ads, which were about 3 or 4 pages of advertising right there. But the Lake County News Chronicle is no more. Forum Communications, who I later worked for and who actually promoted me to editor of the News Tribune, ended the paper a couple of years ago. And so, you know, they're very similar, but one's not here anymore. You're still optimistic about it?
I am. And I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but the paper in International Falls was closed up earlier in June of this year. And we, you know, working with Brian Larson, our editor, we actually worked with a lot of folks up in International Falls, and we started a new newspaper, the Rainy Lake Gazette, which we launched 2 weeks after the journal had closed. So that's a great story, I think, for our industry in general, because it really gave me a lot of confidence that people still want to have a newspaper. And I went up there and I met, you know, the president of the Chamber of Commerce was nice enough to set up a meeting on a day's notice, and met with a whole bunch of business leaders and government leaders and the postmaster, and just collectively agreed we were going to start a new newspaper to replace the one that had closed. And I think we have more local subscribers now than the paper had that when it closed. So I think the community just felt like they would be less of a community without a newspaper, and really rallied around to make sure that they had a paper going forward. You know, people still want to have a newspaper, and if they didn't, they would miss it and regret it. And what we need to do is just make sure that we support our newspapers while they're still here, so we don't have to go through that whole process.
I'd also say that's kind of important what you did, and strategic to immediately start it, because you want to get people while they're still missing it, right? You don't want people to get used to the idea of not having the paper anymore.
Exactly. You don't want it to be out of sight, out of mind.
We are speaking with Jeremy Goldman. He is the head of Cherry Road Technologies, based in New Jersey, and now Cherry Road Media, owners of 27 daily and weekly newspapers, including the Cook County, Minnesota News Herald, and now one in International Falls. So you most recently bought 20 papers from Gannett. This would have been unheard of not too much more than a decade ago, or at least very expensive. I know the Duluth News Tribune, when it was purchased from now defunct Knight Ritter in, I think, 2006, was for $70 million. I'm guessing you didn't pay that for each one.
not quite.
And the Minneapolis Star Tribune by McClatchy not long before that for about $1 billion. So how receptive was Gannett to your purchase overture, and how much was it?
Well, I can't talk about the amount of it because it's confidential, but I really do want to give Gannett a lot of credit, because they are doing the right thing with a lot of the papers that are not part of their strategic vision going forward, and they are actively going out and finding good homes for them as opposed to closing them. So I really think Gannett should be applauded for that. A big company can't manage a local paper the way that it needs to be managed, because it requires a lot of tender, loving care. But they are doing the right thing here, all in various areas of the country where they're finding good homes for their publications. So they were very receptive to working with us. And I think they were excited about someone new coming into the business and the message that sends to the industry overall.
Mm-hmm. And where are all these papers?
So there's 12 or 13 in Kansas, 4 in Missouri, 2 in Nebraska, and 1 in Iowa.
Any plans for Wisconsin, perhaps? I know they have Wausau, Stevens Point, Eau Claire. They have this little city called Milwaukee, too, but I don't know if you want to get into that. But before you answer that, Wausau and Eau Claire, you know, and Stevens Point are kind of like NI Falls and, you know, some of the other areas that you are looking at.
Sure. Yeah, you never know what the future holds. So there's nothing imminent, but you never know.
Okay. All right. Straightforward answer. Again, we are speaking with Jeremy Goldman. He's the head of Cherry Road Technologies, based in New Jersey, and Cherry Road Media, owners of 27,
correct.
Right. Daily and weekly newspapers, including the Cook County, Minnesota News Herald. So back to Grand Marais and the paper. What's the most memorable story that you've read in the News Herald before you bought it and after you bought it?
So before I bought it, I think I was just intrigued with the quality of the content in the newspaper, especially when you look at some of the bigger newspapers today. And when I looked at that newspaper, there was just a lot of pictures, a lot of stories about things going on in the community. And I just thought it was just a lot of content in the paper. And I was really impressed with that. And I just think the world of Brian Larson, the editor up there, I've learned so much from him about, you know, the business and about how to run a newspaper. And I think he was the perfect person for me coming in as a publisher and owner, not knowing the business, to embrace us and work with us on this. And I think the best story that I've seen since we've owned it, he did a really nice historical look back of a gentleman, John Light, who was the sheriff in Cook County for a number of years.
Absolutely.
Really well
written John
story.
Light, yes. Actually, on the same trip, the other name in my book is John Light, and I still have a picture of the two of us together.
Interesting.
Any stories since then? There have been hard news pieces up there. We had an interesting situation with the county attorney, got into some trouble a few years back. And that's the kind of thing, by the way, that wouldn't really be covered too much outside of the town.
Yeah. I don't think there's really been a lot of, you know, big stories like that since we've owned it.
But when there is, you'll be there.
We will be there. Yeah. You know, local community paper is the place where those stories get reported. And when a community doesn't have one, those type of stories can go unreported. So I think that's a critical service that local papers provide.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Jeremy Goben. He's the head of Cherry Road Technologies in New Jersey and Cherry Road Media, owners of 27 daily and weekly newspapers, including the Cook County, Minnesota News Herald. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Robin. I really enjoyed this and look forward to seeing you next time I'm in the area.
So after talking to Jeremy Goben, I had to call editor Brian Larson to check my memory that it was he and his wife that I had dinner with 35 years ago. Like me, Brian hasn't stayed in the same place for a generation and a half and actually spent several years in heavy industry in Taconite Harbor. But he's been back for more than a dozen years, and after putting out this week's paper, he immediately took my call. You remember that dinner, Brian?
Yes. Yeah, I sure do. It was a lot of fun. You were talking about doing some rock climbing and just different things. Yeah, no, it's funny what we remember, but yeah. And you're going to miss some of that and some of the just the outdoor things here in the Northland. So
I did. Actually, yes, I went rappelling off of Palisade Head.
Yep.
And I had to climb back up. I wasn't too thrilled about that part. But
No, I bet you weren't. But you were younger then.
You remember at that dinner, for some reason, I was talking about what I had identified as great moments in music. One of those was Bus Stop by the Hollies.
Yeah.
I remember you seemed to agree with me. Was I that convincing, or is it really that great?
No, really great song. No, absolutely. Bus Stop, yeah. So, and
right.
You talked about your owner being a really good owner of the paper, Two Harbors paper, and yeah. It was just fun.
Right. But when I left to go to big media in Boston, I had a fellowship opportunity. I had no idea I'd be back. And 17 years later, I was. And then with all the newspaper ownership changes, like what we're talking about right now, the Duluth News Tribune ended up having, through various incarnations, bought the Lake County News Chronicle. So when I became editor of the News Tribune, I found that I was the supervising editor of the News Chronicle. I found a manila envelope with my handwriting in it.
Oh, my God. That had to be a little surreal.
It was. But unfortunately, the News Chronicle was shut a few years ago.
Yeah.
But you guys are still going.
Yeah. Our paper is doing pretty well. Jeremy has been, he's a great guy, hard worker, and he's learned a lot about the business, and he's enabled us to make a better paper than we could before. He bought us new computers. Our technology was very old here. He bought me a new camera to take nicer pictures. We can pay columnists now. We can pay for people taking pictures. It's a different game. There's some financial backing there, and there's a lot of goodwill. So we have to get the paper laid out remotely, and it's got some challenges to be sure, but everybody I've worked with at Cherry Road, every single person has been really, really nice.
What's your reaction to the idea of anybody even buying newspapers, let alone he picked up 20 from Gannett?
Again, that's a pretty much a welcome thing, in my opinion, because I'm a fan of newspapers. Jeremy's trying to level the playing field a little bit with the big tech companies that, you know, Facebooks of the world and Twitter and everybody. They've kind of gobbled up most of the advertising dollars. He's trying to do a combination of both, you know. We're online. Our paper, I think, just pops online, by the way.
All right. We're speaking with Brian Larson, the editor and publisher of the Cook County News Herald in Grand Marais, Minnesota, now a Cherry Road Media newspaper, and someone I had dinner with, and most memorably, 35 years ago. Want to get together for dinner again in 35 years or maybe sooner? What do you think?
I think sooner. But yeah, I'd love to, Robin. That'd be great.
All right, and we'll bring hard copy newspapers, right?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, and since it's still in my head, I might be humming this.
Bus stop, wet day, she's there, I say, be sure. day's love grows under my umbrella. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That umbrella we employed it, by August she was mine. Every morning I would see her waiting at the stop.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Linda Lagarde Grover is one of our region's most celebrated authors. Her works include novels, poetry, and story compilations that have garnered numerous honors, including a bunch of Minnesota Book Awards and Northeastern Minnesota Book Awards, if we have to limit it to geography, as well as the Native Writers and Storytellers Fictions Awards for her Ojibwe stories as an enrolled member of the Boys Fort Band, and the Flannery O'Connor Award for her short stories. She's Professor Emeritus in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and her latest book is a memoir of her family's roots in the region, particularly the Point of Rocks area of Duluth, but also going back millennia in the trek of the Ojibwe people from the northeastern part of the continent to what is now Minnesota via Madeline Island. I'll let her give the specific route as well as where she went from there. Her latest book is Gitchigami Hearts, and welcome back to Simply Superior, Linda Lagarde Grover.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It's wonderful to talk with you again, and great to have Gitchigami Hearts out in an actual book form too.
And I have to say, I have a coveted copy, which I understand, thanks to the supply chain issues, is pretty hard to get. Yes.
Yes, there have been. You know, and I guess it's not only across the country, but across the world, some distribution kind of issues going on in the book world here. And So we had copies at Zenith Bookstore at the launch for this book last Thursday. And so they had plenty there. But since then, there are not a whole lot available. I have a couple. I expect Zenith still has a few. And they're on their way.
So this isn't actually your first memoir, though, because one of the awards you have, and previously I've asked you how many books, and I'm not going to name them also, but one was the 2018 Minnesota Book Award for memoir. So you've written your story before, your family story? Tell us.
Well, I'm kind of in the story, it's true, because it's experiences I've had and things I've seen and heard and thought about, and Anagamasing, which came out in, I think, 2017, 2018, that won the Minnesota Book Award for Memoir and Creative Nonfiction. And it's a combination of the two. And that's 50 very short little articles, essays, about living here in the Duluth region. And Anagamasing is one of the Ojibwe words for the area here. It means, in English, the place of the small portage. And so Gitchigami Hearts is part memoir. It's part a sharing of some aspects of the very old stories. It has some fiction in it. It has some poetry. And it's quite an interweaving, I guess. I don't know if I'd even call it a mixture, because they are woven in with each other. So there are things about very old histories here in this book, and then about living here in this region today. And so the subtitle of this book, Gitchigami Hearts, you know, Gitchigami refers to, you know, Lake Superior, the big lake. And then the subtitle is Stories and Histories from Mesabi Kong. And Mesabi Kong is another of the words to describe this place here. And in English, it would mean the place of the giants.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of English and language and memoir, you also speak of some European ancestors too, but not Italian, I notice in one of the stories. It says, I'm not Italian, although I do have some Italian traditions I picked up.
Yes, I read a little in there about, you know, the immigrant cultures that came to this region. And one of my grandfathers was Norwegian. And although it's true, I'm not Italian myself, one of my teachers, Miss Andreese from Denfeld, when I'd first written a little column in the Budgeter about life among the Italians, and you know how much I love the experience of having been around a large extended Italian family all through my life, and they are like step relatives of my mother's family, and she said, "Why, Linda, I had no idea that you had an Italian childhood," and we both laughed. But you know, that's part of living here too. I mean, we're real Americans here, I guess, because we have had many interactions and encounters, certainly with people who have come in. We Ojibwe here. And in the book, too, I write about the long trip that the Ojibwe took to come to this region hundreds of years ago from the East Coast regions up into Maine and up into Canada and Newfoundland. And that is called the Ojibwe Great Migration. And the ancestors undertook a really long journey a long time ago, and some stopped along the way following a route roughly along the Great Lakes, and so there were certainly communities and tribes that settled in once they arrived somewhere. And for the people here, I'm descended from, or well, some went up into Canada and then down into Minnesota, and then some took the southern route along Lake Superior and lived in at Madeline Island there at La Pointe, and then eventually some came to Duluth. Well, not Duluth, actually. It's the far western part, you know, the old Fond du Lac settlement there. And some came down from Canada and settled in Net Lake, Minnesota, Boyce Fork, and some in Fond du Lac also. So it's a movable and moving history, I think you'd call it.
Right. Literally and spiritually.
Absolutely spiritually.
We're speaking with Linda Lagarde Grover, one of our most celebrated authors in the area. Her new volume is Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Misabikang. Part of it is telling the journey of her family and then broader the Ojibwe people from the East Coast to our region here today. Madeline Island, what happened there? Who settled there?
Ojibwe people. There were stopping places along the route, and there are, in many, many ways of recounting the history, there are stopping places that were and are considered to be sacred places. And so Madeline Island was one of those stopping places. And it was a long stop there for many people. And there was a large community there. And I have heard the time called that they lived there, the golden age of the Ojibwe. It was probably, I don't know, about a century and a half, and when it was a large community. The reason they call it the Golden Age is it was a time of great peace and prosperity. And by prosperity, I mean living where there was plenty to eat, and people were sheltered, and people lived in harmony with each other. And it's a beautiful part of the story. My relative, great-great-great-grandparents, perhaps, a young married couple who were married by Father Baraga, I think it was in the 1830s at the mission, you know, because there were missionaries, of course, moving in as fast as they could inland here. He married a number of people there.
And that was part of his conversion efforts, I take it.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, that's absolutely.
They didn't need him to get married, but, you know, it was a nicety that it happened, maybe more than that, right?
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, and that's just part of what history is. You know, certainly there are difficult things in history and things that are, you know, it's a real spectrum of experiences there. And so,
right.
But it is our history. And so I'm a person who loves history kinds of things, always loved it in school. And I guess as I studied history, picturing that these ancestors of ours were real people. And, you know, they had their lives just as we do. And they, you know, they had their, you know, perhaps their favorite soup, you know, and deciding that they really, really needed a new coat or something for the winter. Just like, you know, like we do today.
Again, we're speaking with Linda Lagarde Grover. Her new volume is Gichigami Hearts. It is a memoir and more, telling of her family and the broader ancestry of the Ojibwe people coming from the northeast of the continent via Madeline Island to the Duluth area and then parts north and west and south from there, too. So where exactly does your family go at that point? Since you are a member of the Boys Fort Band.
Oh, the Boys Fort Band. And so, yeah, those were children and grandchildren of the young couple from who traveled to Fond du Lac. And so their children then, some of them headed north, and one of their granddaughters then married a man up at Boys Fort, and that is where my branch of the family is. And so they settled there, and when Boys Fort was established as a reservation, and that's after 1854, then that became where their assigned land was, as it was for probably all of the people under that treaty. That was a land cession treaty, and so that involved signing vast amounts of land away, and under the terms of the treaty, then small amounts of land then would be returned to each band, and it would be reserved for them, and that's where the term reservation comes from.
Mm-hmm. And the bands, is that where they acquire their names and identities? And or let me ask it this way: are the differences actual? And I'm not looking for differences between people, but on the other hand, that's what culture is all about, right? The Italian cooking that you picked up, perhaps. are the differences sort of by the people themselves, or were they something assigned to them? And I'm thinking, if I'm not getting too esoteric, there's this whole school of thought of how the Middle East got to be, that Britain and France and the European powers just divided up these areas of land and put arbitrary borders on it and created something called an Iraqi. And actually today, well, Iraqis are like 3 or 4 or 5 different cultures. And, you know, they're not really, they became Iraqi, if you will, but they were actually just convenient borders established by Europeans. So I'm wondering if the treaties established the groups, or were the groups established by themselves?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. And, you know, even though every band, every tribal government, every neighborhood, every family has its own traditions and its own ways of doing things, we are all Ojibwe, of the people that I'm speaking of here. And so any differences that had to do with movement to reservations and established boundaries like that, the reservation boundaries, they were negotiated and treaty terms. Now, of course, the Ojibwe people were at a very large disadvantage in this. They, you know, certainly people's backs were up against the wall. But but in moving to smaller areas, these were often areas where there were already members of that very, very loosely, and I don't know if you even call it organized, bands living there. You know, certainly we are Ojibwe people, we're Anishinaabe people, which is a broader sense of the word for Ojibwe people. And we identify, many of us do, with our tribal governments and those bands. And so it was just the way things were organized. And so today, you know, our tribal governments are much much stronger, and they're closer to having the strength that they had in days long ago. And so we tend to identify with that. But it's not like it mm-hmm. is a, you know, my grandfather was from Fond du Lac and my grandmother from Boys Fort, Net Lake. And it's not like they were from different cultures or anything. In fact, they met at the same Indian boarding school, you know. And so
Exactly. Nobody's DNA is different. And of course, race is an illusion and an assigned human attribute anyway, completely political. So.
Well, but it's fascinating to look at, isn't it? Don't you think?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
And I love your analogy of neighborhoods. And that's exactly it because, well, we certainly know about neighborhoods in Duluth and Superior.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we do.
Right?
Yes, we do.
And if you look at any migration, I guess, of any people, European, Asian, Latino. There are so many tales of a particular group. One person moves to a particular neighborhood and then tells their relatives, hey, I'm living in Lincoln Park in Duluth, although they wouldn't have called it Lincoln Park at the time. And you guys should come up there, and they move on the same block, right? And that's the way you get a neighborhood in, you know, ethnic neighborhoods.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think you're right. I think that's, you know, one person moves there and somebody else moves there, too. And there's a lot of reasons for movement. You know, people are often, you know, they're looking for something. You know, it can be a better life, or it can be that, you know, a long time ago that food became really scarce, or the climate changed. It became, you know, less hospitable to the people living there. The Great Ojibwe migration was actually a spiritual, a religious migration. And there are several stories that have their own, you know, variations to it, but they're basically the same, where there began to be dreams and visions and directions coming from the Creator, from the Great Spirit, that people should be moving westward and following this vision, and to have faith in this, that it was not going to be an easy journey, but that it was meant to be, and to have faith that all would be provided, which turned out to be true, of course.
Again, we're speaking with Linda Lagarde Grover, author of Getchigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Missabacong. And I'm wondering if you could read one of those stories.
Okay, so this is from The Listening and Remembering by Heart. In Ojibwe oral tradition, stories about the creation of the world and how the earth came to be the way it is today are told during the winter months, when there is snow on the ground. The stories are a gift with reason and purpose. There are lessons in the wintertime stories and explanations. They are the foundation of Ojibwe religious beliefs, and they're entertaining and interwoven with the stories of our ancestors' lives as well as our own. Nana Buju made foolish, selfish mistakes. He acted heroically and with compassion. So did our grandparents, and so do we. Like the ancestors, we are reliving the sacred stories every day, and as it was with them, the stories have become part of us, and we have become part of the stories. When my Aunt Carol talked with me about the travel of our ancestors from Madeline Island to Fond du Lac and the American Fur Post, we both understood that our own family saga was a continuation of the great Ojibwe migration from the east, the journey undertaken because of dreams and visions sent by the Creator. She wondered about the earlier part of the journey, what it was like to take on the long trip from the East Coast along the Great Lakes to Madeline Island, and the unseen but true interweaving of religious teachings with the necessities of survival during the concurrent snowball effects of fur trade workers pouring into North America. She mentioned marriages between fur trade employees and the women in our family, some by the Catholic missionaries and some under no legal or church auspices at all. Some of our great-great-grandmothers were abandoned by their husbands, who then legally married Euro-American women. It was always hard for women, always. And our grandmothers had terrible experiences, including at the boarding school when they were just young girls. And this bothered Aunt Carol greatly as she spoke. Then she sat up straight and said that we couldn't know why these things happened, but they were meant to be. She wanted me to know these things, she said, and she wanted me to remember. There were so many stories and yet so much missing, so much to remember and so much absence to mourn. Eventually, this is what I learned, that Aunt Carol saw all of the stories, past and present, spiritual and romantic, ghostly and mysterious, as interwoven, that our lives, hers and mine, were a small part of a much larger story. She told me what she remembered and thought about, and I listened and learned to remember by heart.
And that was an excerpt from Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Missabekong, read by the author and our guest, Linda Lagarde Grover. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin. It's always so wonderful to talk with you.
You too. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, if anyone's having trouble logging onto the internet in rural Wisconsin, help may be on the way.
Yeah, that's right. State regulators just awarded around $100 million in COVID-19 stimulus funds to expand broadband internet to nearly 30,000 homes and businesses across Wisconsin. And that includes five projects that will be funded by Norvado, which is a Northern Wisconsin internet service provider. They received funding for several projects in Bayfield, Sawyer, and Price counties to expand fiber infrastructure to homes. And also, ResConnect received an award to expand fiber infrastructure to businesses and residences in Ashland County. And so the Bad River Band of Lake Superior received a $6 million award as part of those funds. And those funds were made available by Governor Tony Evers after states received funding through the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan Act, which, you know, seeks to help people recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. And so, I spoke to Chad Young, who's the CEO and general manager of Norvado, and he said that these kind of projects are really expensive to do in rural areas because it can be tens of thousands of dollars per mile to lay that infrastructure in the ground and get it to people. And so this really is a shot in the arm. It would help them do this kind of work faster than they would have been able to do it on their own, or it really makes the business case for that. And in rural Wisconsin, you know, they're really struggling to get high-speed internet to folks. So this is something that's being hailed by internet service providers and local governments as a shot in the arm and getting people up to speed, especially with what we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic with people working remotely from home and learning online.
Great. That does sound like good news. And if you want to power your internet or computer with the sun, you might have good news coming too, right? From a politically unlikely source.
Yeah, that's right. Recently, Republican lawmakers are looking to introduce a bill that would make it more affordable for residents in the state and businesses and local governments and other groups to invest in solar power and support the clean energy transition. And solar advocates are really hailing this legislation, but it's getting some pushback from large investor-owned utilities. Basically, what the bill would do is it would allow leasing of solar panels and eliminate confusion under state law that's pretty much barred third-party financing of solar systems. And that's when a third party, like a solar developer, pays the upfront costs of installing solar and allows the customer to pay it off over time. Right now, the Public Service Commission has issued some confusing guidance on whether those solar developers are considered a public utility when they do this kind of financing. And if they are considered a public utility, that means that they'd have to get approval from the PSC. So regulators really haven't clarified this issue. It's preventing some solar developers from offering this to clients who are seeking this financing option because they don't have the money to invest upfront in rooftop solar projects. And so solar advocates like Check Bay Renewables, which has been working on this in the Shawamigan Bay region, are glad that this bill would remove that confusion and give developers the clarity they need to move forward. The group's president, Bill Bailey, said they're ready to do projects like this or do third-party financing, but they just want that clarity that it's not going to result in a lawsuit, which it has in cases downstate in Milwaukee. The state's largest utility, We Energies, basically blocked a Iowa solar developer from putting solar panels on buildings in Milwaukee and connecting into the utility's system. They say that solar developers shouldn't be allowed to operate as unregulated utilities. But folks like Bill Bailey say that's just a smokescreen and that they're worried about this cutting into their bottom line. And that, you know, when everybody invests in solar or has this option available, we're able to drive down costs and see more expansion of renewable energy.
Okay. Well, we've had a lot of discussions about policing on the show, and it's a topic throughout the state.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, really, what we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic and the national reckoning over racial justice is that Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have had a really difficult time recruiting and keeping officers. And it's something that they've had trouble with for years, but the pandemic and rising violence and intense scrutiny of police have just made it more challenging for them to attract and keep officers. And in Superior, you know, Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander said that he received around 48 applicants last year from people who are interested in being new recruits. And that was less than half the applications he's received in his first few years as chief when he was sworn in 2015. And this is something that we're seeing with departments across the state, large and small. A national survey of nearly 200 police departments found that hiring dropped by 5%, while retirements rose 45% and resignations climbed by 18% from April of last year to the spring. And departments like the Milwaukee Police Department have really seen a large outflow of officers in the wake of massive protests that unfolded last year in response to Derek Chauvin killing George Floyd. But in our state's largest city, Milwaukee has seen retirements increase 40% in the last year, and they've lost more than 500 Milwaukee officers in the last 5 years, and they're set to hit a record 20-year low for police staffing. And that's all coming as killings have spiked in the city. Last year, they saw a record 190 homicides. And so there's a lot of debate going on right now about whether there should be investment in police staffing. This all comes as groups are talking about defunding police and shifting resources away from law enforcement into social service programs to address the root causes of poverty and violence. And so not all are welcoming this kind of investment in law enforcement, saying that there's no evidence to prove that it would make their community safer.
All right. Well, no easy. Brooks, on the Minnesota side, you have an update on Visit Duluth, which we've also talked about a few times on the show.
Yeah, one of the loose ends of the recent sort of brouhaha over Visit Duluth and Duluth's tourism marketing partner is getting resolved. So the Visit Duluth board this week agreed, after months of kind of waiting, to work with the city after all. And continue providing convention, event, and sports sales, along with visitor center services. To rewind, Belmont Partners out of the Twin Cities was selected this summer as the new marketing agency to sell Duluth to the greater public and get more visitors to come up here. Visit Duluth had performed those services for decades, nearly a century, really. But the city went out for a request for proposals and found that Belmont performed better in their interviews. Now, Visit Duluth, the contract is going to be a lot smaller than it was. Belmont's getting $1.8 million next year to perform these services. And as of this recording, the number for Visit Duluth is still up in the air, and the Duluth City Council is going to vote on that on Monday.
All right. Well, if you want to visit Island Lake beyond Duluth, and you like it so much you want to stay, you might talk to Minnesota Power about buying some land.
Yeah, that would be a pretty new thing, actually, up there. So Minnesota Power has owned most of the land around Island Lake, Fish Lake, and Whiteface Reservoir for about 100 years. And those were created by Those are reservoirs created by hydropower that Minnesota Power has operated there. Over the past few years, the utility has tried to unload that property, saying it's no longer needed and it wants to sell it. It's gone through a federal regulatory process and just this month got state approval to sell that land to leaseholders. It's a very highly developed area now, a lot of cabins, a lot of even year-round properties. And what this land sale program does is allow the people who are leasing property on Island Lake and several other reservoirs to buy the land from Minnesota Power at market value. It's a little complicated from there, but I'll just, the details are, if you buy before 2024, you can buy your lot at the 2020 market value plus 4%. Most folks have come around and said, well, if it's a decision we have to make, it's a good deal. That's what one resident told me, but we wish it was a better deal. And so we'll see some land changing hands over the next decade or so up around those reservoirs.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. A listener contacted us this week asking about the lyrics to our theme song, which is written and performed by Bruce Nelson of South Range. Though some people have asked if it's me singing, and I trust you, it is not. Bruce's singing voice is quite clear, but the lyrics in question are Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view, gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear by sharing the stories and information you'll enjoy and want to hear. We'll let Bruce take it from there. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view, gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear by sharing the stories and information you'll enjoy and